How many women do you know who could have done what she did today? Gavet asked now, looking around at his father and the others. Shan Wei, Anvil Rock retorted. Ask me how many men I know who could have done what she did today. Either way, men or women. The answer is damned few, Tartarian said. And don't think for a moment all those witnesses didn't realize it too. Oh, I'm sure a lot of it was political calculation. She had to know how it would affect all of us. But even if that's true, she managed to do it. And I think it was at least as sincere as it was calculated. Probably more, to be honest. I think you're right, Gavet said. And I have to ask myself whether or not those reports about her being uninjured are truly accurate. Her ribs, you mean? Winchair asked. Gavet nodded, and the dashing young earl shrugged. I noticed that, too. Not that surprising, I suppose, with Merlin landing on top of her that way. Must have bruised the hell out of her.
I think they were more than just bruised, Doyle said quietly. I think it's entirely possible they were broken.
Nonsense, Anvil Rock objected. I'm as impressed with her as any of you, but let's not get too carried away. Broken ribs are no joke. I've had my share of them over the years, by God. If she had had that, on top of almost being killed, not even she would have just sat there.
With all due respect, my lord, Doyle replied,
don't forget that this isn't the first time she's almost been killed.
Think about that affair at St. Agatha's. According to my reports, she picked up her dead guardsman's rifles and killed at least a dozen of the attackers herself.
He shook his head.
Whatever else Charlien Armach may be, she's no hothouse flower. In fact, I'm coming to the opinion that she's even tougher than we thought she was.
Gavet started to say something, then changed his mind and sat back in his chair. His father didn't seem to notice, but one of Tartarian's eyebrows quirked slightly. He looked a question at the younger Gavet, but Sir Corin only shook his head with a smile and listened, while Duke Anvil Rock disposed of the notion that even Empress Charlien wouldn't have continued to dispense justice with broken ribs. Tartarian let the moment pass, and Gavet was just as happy he had. After all, there was time to double-check his men's report in the morning. The would-be assassin's first bullet had to have gone somewhere, and the fact that no one had been able to find it yet proved nothing. He'd been certain they were going to find it embedded in the massive throne somewhere, but they hadn't. Which meant it had to have hit the rear wall instead, didn't it? Of course it did. Still, probably better to keep his mouth shut until they did manage to find it. If his father found Doyle's notion that Charlien had managed to go right on with broken ribs ridiculous, he would have found the suggestion that perhaps, just perhaps, that bullet hadn't completely missed its mark after all ludicrous.
Because it is ludicrous, Corin, Gavet told himself firmly. Absolutely ludicrous.
I never want to hear another word about how stubborn Caleb is, Merlin Athroys said severely as he helped Charlien across her bedchamber. The rush of pouring rain and the rumble of thunder half drowned his voice, but she heard him and looked up with a battered, bruised, but still game smile. He was glad to see it, but he'd been less than amused when he'd first gotten her back here. The adrenaline, determination, and sheer willpower which had carried her from Princess Alethea's ballroom to her own suite had deserted her once she crossed the threshold. She had virtually collapsed into Merlin's arms, and Ser A. Halmin had fluttered around the Sagin in shocked dismay as he'd scooped her up, carried her to her sleeping chamber, and deposited her gently on the enormous bed. Sarah's dismay had turned into something very like outrage as Merlin began calmly unbuttoning and unlacing the Empress' gown.
"Sagin, Merlin, what do you think you're doing?"
"Oh, hush, Sarah," Charlien had said weakly, her voice much thinner and breathless than usual. "The Sagin's a healer as well as a warrior, you ninny."
"But, Your Majesty..."
"I am not going to have a Coruscantian healer in here examining me,"
Charlian had said flatly, sounding much more like her usual self for a moment. "The last thing we need is some wild rumour about how I was actually shot after all, and you know that's what would happen if word got out that I'd summoned healers to my bedchamber. By Langhorne's watch, they'd have me on my deathbed."
"But, Your Majesty..."
"There's no point arguing with her, Sarah," Merlin had said in a resigned voice. "Trust me. If there is any serious damage, Edward and I will have a healer in here in a heartbeat, whatever she says. But she's probably right about the rumour potential, so if it's only bruising..."
"But, Your Majesty..."
The third attempt had been little more than pro forma, and Charlian had actually smiled as she shook her head. "I won't say I'm as stubborn as Caleb, no matter what Merlin thinks," she had said. "But I am stubborn enough to win this argument, Sarah. So why don't you just concentrate on brewing me some tea with lots of sugar? Trust me, I could use it."
"Very well, Your Majesty,"
Sarah had finally conceded defeat. She had given Merlin one last moderately outraged look, then marched out past Sergeant Seahamper. The sergeant had looked at Charlian for a moment, shaken his head with a pronounced air of resignation, and moved his gaze to Merlin.
"Good luck getting her to see reason," he had said a bit sourly.
Then he had tapped the ear, holding his own comm earplug.
"And somehow, I don't think His Majesty's going to hold off on yelling at her very much longer, even if it is the middle of the night in Talisberg. Maybe we can at least get Owl to give them a private channel," Merlin had said hopefully.
Seahamper had snorted, given Charlian one last look, then closed the door.
"It's not like I'm a complete idiot,"
the Empress had said plaintively, then gasped as Merlin lifted her gently into a sitting position to peel the gown down from her shoulders. "Even if there'd been another one of them out there, it's not like I was running the kind of risk Michael ran in the cathedral."
"There shouldn't have been any of them," Merlin had said through his teeth. "How in God's name did they get a damned pistol past Garvey's guards?"
"I've been checking the record from the Snark's sensors," Seahamper had said over the comm from the other side of the bedchamber's closed door. "Owls managed to pick up the moment he was admitted. He was carrying the real Grassman summons. Grassman was on the list from the first session, and it never occurred to any of us to tell them to look for firearms concealed inside someone's tunic, because it hadn't occurred to us that anyone could fit one inside his tunic. And if you want something to make you feel even better, Merlin, Owl's run the imagery through his facial recognition software. Underneath all that beard and the tattoo, it was none other than our elusive friend, Patrick Henry."
The sergeant's tone had been almost conversational, and Merlin had known he was almost certainly right about the confluence of factors which had allowed the gunman to get past Garvey's guardsmen. No one on Safehold had ever heard of a photo ID, so unless Henry had run into someone who'd remembered the real Grassman from the previous session, there was precious little way anyone could have spotted the deception. Besides, if Owl was right, and it had been Henry, they'd already had ample evidence he was, or had been at any rate, fiendishly good at getting into and out of places where he wasn't supposed to be. But Seahamper's calm tone hadn't fooled him. The sergeant was probably even more upset with himself than Merlin was with himself. This was exactly the sort of thing they were supposed to prevent. "Don't the two of you pick on yourselves over this," Charlian had scolded as Merlin gently eased down her chemise. "In a crowd that size, one man, and a man who had had the exact documentation he was supposed to have?" She had shaken her head. "Ideally, maybe you and the Snark should have spotted him. In fact, though, it's not at all surprising to me that someone managed to get past you. For that matter, Merlin, you and Edward argued against this approach from the beginning exactly because you were afraid of something like this. So why aren't you simply saying, 'I told you so,' and letting it go at that?"
"Because you damn near got yourself killed this morning," Merlin had snapped.
He had paused, looking down into her face, his sapphire eyes dark. "I've lost too many of you already, Charlie. I'm not about to lose any more." "Of course you're not," she'd said softly, laying one hand on his mailed forearm. "And I didn't mean to sound flip, but that doesn't make anything I just said untrue, does it? Besides," she had smiled impishly, "at least we've just demonstrated that Owl's tailoring works."
"More or less," Merlin had conceded, and grimaced as he ran his fingertips lightly across the huge, discolored bruise on Charlian's ribcage. "On the other hand, it didn't spread the kinetic energy as well as I could have wished. You've got at least 2 broken ribs here, Charlie. Probably 3. I'm seriously tempted to whisk you off to the cave tonight and let Owl's auto doc take a look at you."
"I don't think that's going to be Ness." "Ow!"
Charlian had flinched as he had pressed just a bit harder. He had shaken his head in apology, and she had sucked in a deep breath.
"I don't think that's going to be necessary," she said. "Even if they're broken, I mean. Isn't this one of the reasons you inoculated us with the medical nanotech?"
"It'll help you heal faster. What it won't do is heal this overnight," Merlin had retorted. "And it's not going to help much with the pain either. If you think this is bad now, you just wait till you wake up and try to move in the morning."
"I know," she had said glumly. "This isn't the first time I've broken them."
"You and that damned pony," Sea Hamper had muttered over the comm,
and she'd giggled, then gasped in pain. "Exactly," she'd said, and looked up at Merlin. "I'm perfectly prepared to be indisposed in the morning, at least, as long as I can get to breakfast with the Regency Council without looking too much like I've been beaten with a stick. I figure they'll expect at least a little morning-after reaction out of me. So if we just strap up my ribs tightly, I can get through that much, I think. Then I promise I'll come straight back here and spend the day resting while all those busy little nanites work on fixing me."
"What do you think, Edward?" Merlin had asked. "Unless you're ready to knock her on the head, that's probably as close to a reasonable attitude as you're likely to get out of her," Sea Hamper had said sourly.
"Besides," he'd gone on a bit grudgingly,
"it might not be a very good idea to have her incommunicado after something like this. I doubt anyone's going to come calling in the middle of the night, but the two of you would be gone for hours, and if something does come up, I won't be able to fob people off the way I might get away with in Chereith. I'm sorry, the Empress is unavailable, isn't going to cut it after something like this morning."
"You're probably right," Merlin had sighed, then looked down at Charlian and shaken his head. "Too bad current Safeholdian fashion doesn't include corsets," he had said with a lurking smile. "They're probably the most fiendish device this side of the Inquisition, but just this once they'd actually come in handy. Since we don't have them, though, let's get you the rest of the way out of your clothes and see what we can do about strapping up those ribs." That had been the better part of 6 hours ago, and Sea Hamper had been right about Caleb's reaction. The Emperor had indeed gotten Owl to give him a private connection to Charlian, but her side of the conversation had been remarkably monosyllabic, consisting primarily of yes or no, interspersed with an occasional, "Of course I won't," and even a single, "Whatever you say." It had all been most unlike her, and it probably said a great deal about how deeply she'd been shaken, however composed she might have seemed on the surface. Now Merlin helped her the last few feet from the bathroom. She made 2 or 3 false starts on getting herself turned around and folding down to sit on the bed, then gasped as Merlin scooped her up and effortlessly laid her down again.
"Thank you."
She smiled tightly up at him, as lightning wickered beyond her window, briefly etching his profile against the panes, and thunder crashed.
"As a matter of fact, this is quite a bit worse than the falling off the pony episode."
"You don't say," Merlin replied dryly, then sighed, looking down at the ugly bruise on the left side of her face. His elbow had done that, he knew, and it was almost as dark as the one on her ribcage, he thought as he touched it with a gentle fingertip. They were lucky he hadn't broken her cheekbone as well. "Sorry about that," he said with a sad little smile. "Why? For saving my life the second time?" She reached up and caught his hand, holding it for a moment. "This seems to be getting to be quite a habit for you where our marks are concerned, doesn't it? Look, there's even a thunderstorm. Do you think you could get over it by the time Alana grows up?"
"I'll try, Your Majesty. I'll certainly try. And when she's a bit older," Merlin reached into his belt pouch, "maybe she'd like a little memento of her first trip to Coruscant with you."
"Memento?" Charlian repeated, then looked down as he laid something small and heavy in the palm of her hand. The pistol bullet was an ugly, flattened lump that gleamed dully in the light from her bedside lamp.
"Sure." Merlin looked into her eyes again. "It's not every mother who's already survived two separate assassination attempts before her first child's even a year old. But you know, it's all pretty fatiguing for us poor bodyguards. So let's not try going for number three until Alana's at least, seven, let's say. All right?"
10. Tellersberg Palace, City of Tellersberg, Kingdom of Old Caris. King Gorja of Taro was not a large man. He was a little taller than Prince Narman, not a difficult achievement, but far less substantial. Of course, he was also considerably younger, only a few years older than Caleb himself, and he hadn't spent as many years in self-indulgence as Narman had. He was exquisitely tailored, his steel thistle silk tunic rustling as he moved, and his kerchief, the traditional headwear of Taro, was beautifully embroidered and glinted with the scattered flash of faceted gems. All in all, he was the perfect dictionary illustration of a well-groomed, wealthy young monarch, perfectly turned out for an important social occasion. He was not, needless to say, the sartorial equal of the waiting emperor, whose crown of state flashed blue and red fire from rubies and sapphires, and whose ornate, embroidered, jewelled, and infernally hot, robes of state were trimmed with the winter-white fur of the mountain-slash-lizard. Still, Caleb had to give him what Merlin would have called points for style, especially under the present circumstances. He had obviously taken great pains to get his appearance exactly right for the occasion. At the moment, however, he also had the look of a man who was distinctly nervous, but doing surprisingly well at concealing it. He had entered the throne room behind the chamberlain who had announced his arrival, and he walked sedately towards the paired thrones at its end, ignoring the clusters of courtiers, counsellors, and clerics who had been assembled for his arrival. It couldn't have been easy to do that, Caleb reflected, watching Gorja come. Of the five realms which had attacked Caris at the beginning of the war, Taro was the only one who had ever been a Carisian ally. As a matter of fact, Gorja had been bound by a solemn mutual defense treaty to come to Caris's aid, and what he'd actually done was to pretend he intended to do exactly that, even as he sent his own navy to rendezvous with the Dolaran galley fleet, sailing to complete Caris's ruin. Needless to say, the kingdom of Taro and its monarch were less than universally beloved in Tellersburg. At least the guards managed to keep anyone from throwing rotten vegetables at him, Caleb thought dryly. Under the circumstances, that's doing pretty well, given the fractiousness of Carisians in general. And then there's probably the odd temple loyalist who would love the opportunity to stick a knife in his ribs for turning around and betraying Clintan in turn by signing back up with us.
poor bastard can't win for losing, can he? Actually, the Emperor found it difficult to blame Gorgia. Not that he intended to admit anything of the sort until he was positive the Tarosian monarch would never even contemplate reprising his treason. Which is one place where Clintan's reputation's actually going to work for us. Caleb thought with considerably less amusement. Only a frigging idiot would even think about coming back into his reach after crossing him this way. Gorgia reached the foot of the dais, stopped, and bowed deeply. "Your Majesty," he said. Caleb allowed the silence to stretch out for 4 or 5 seconds, letting Gorgia remain bent in his formal bow, then cleared his throat. "King Gorgia," he replied at last. "Until quite recently, I hadn't anticipated the possibility of your visiting here in Talisburg." "Ah, no, Your Majesty." Gorgia straightened and coughed delicately. "I don't suppose either of us expected to see one another again quite so soon." "Oh, I'd anticipated visiting you very soon now," Caleb assured him with a pointed smile, and Gorgia's expression wavered for a moment. Then he squared his shoulders and nodded. "I suppose I deserved that," he said with what Caleb privately thought was admirable calm. "And while I won't pretend I would have enjoyed the sort of visit you had in mind, Your Majesty, I doubt any reasonable man could have quibbled with your motivation." "Probably not," Caleb agreed, sitting back in his throne and wishing Charlian was in the empty throne beside him rather than stretched out on a sofa in her suite in Manchir, nursing her broken ribs. "But you're here now," he continued, "and it would be churlish to treat you discourteously, or for that matter, to pretend you had a great deal of choice when the group of four sent you your marching orders. After all," he reached out and touched the arm of that empty throne, "not even Queen Charlian saw a way to refuse the Lords of the Temple Land's demands. What matters are the present and the future, not the past." He nodded at where Narman Bates, the golden chain of an imperial counsellor around his neck, stood watching. "What's done is done, and past enmities are something none of us can afford in the face of the threat we all face." "I agree, Your Majesty." Gorgia met his gaze levelly. "And while I'm not pretending things, I won't pretend the thought of openly defying Mother Church isn't frightening. Leaving aside the spiritual aspects of all this, the Church's power in the mortal world is enough to give anyone pause. But I've seen the other side from inside the belly of the beast, as it were." He shook his head, his expression grim, and Caleb saw nothing but sincerity in his brown eyes. "If I'd ever doubted Clintan was mad, his purges and executions and his auto-da-fe have proven he is. Whatever he may have thought when he started this, by now he's convinced that anyone who's not totally subservient to him, not to Mother Church or God, has no right even to exist. Confronting someone who thinks that way and controls all the power of the Inquisition is enough to terrify anyone. But the thought of what this world will become if someone like him wins is even more terrifying." Caleb looked back at him in silence, letting his words settle into the corners of the throne room. He thought the Tarosian was sincere, although he also knew Gorgia was less than pleased, to put it mildly, at the present turn of events. It was true he couldn't realistically have resisted the group of four's demand that he betray Karis, but it was equally true he hadn't even been tempted to try. He'd always resented that treaty, the way in which he'd felt it turned Taro into little more than a dependency of the kingdom of Karis. And now he found himself forced to make formal submission, to turn his kingdom into a mere province of the Empire of Karis. That had to stick in his craw like fish bones, and perhaps that was the most fitting vengeance of all for his treachery.
especially since there was no possible path back from the step he was about to take as long as the group of four breathed.
"In that case, King Gorgia," he said, "I suppose we should get on with it."
"Of course, Your Majesty." Gorgia bowed again, then waited while a page placed an elaborately embroidered cushion on the uppermost step of the dais before Caleb's throne. The page bowed to him and walked backwards away from the throne, and Gorgia knelt gracefully. Archbishop Michael stepped forward on Caleb's right and held out the gold and gem-clasped copy of the Holy Writ, and the king kissed the book, then laid his right hand upon it and looked up at Caleb. "I, Gorgia Alexander Nayu, do swear allegiance and fealty to Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian of Caris," he said, his voice unflinching, if not joyous, "to be their true man of heart, will, body, and sword, to do my utmost to discharge my obligations and duty to them, to their crowns, and to their house in all ways, as God shall give me the ability and the wit so to do. I swear this oath without mental or moral reservation, and I submit myself to the judgment of the Emperor and Empress and of God himself for the fidelity with which I honour and discharge the obligations I now assume before God and this company." Caleb reached out and laid his right hand atop Gorgia's and met the kneeling king's eyes levelly. "And we, Caleb Zahn Harald Brian Armach, in our own name, and in that of Charlian Adel Alana Armach, do accept your oath. We will extend protection against all enemies, loyalty for fealty, justice for justice, fidelity for fidelity, and punishment for oath-breaking. May God judge us and ours as he judges you and yours." They stayed that way for a handful of seconds, hands touching, eyes meeting, and then Caleb withdrew his hand and nodded. "And that's that," he said with an off-center smile. "So, now that we've got it out of the way," he stood, waving one hand in invitation to his newest vassal as he started down from the dais, "why don't we get down to work? And let me get out of this damned outfit." 11. Ship Chandler Quay, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant. It was rather different from her arrival, Charlian Armach thought, as the carriage rolled down Prince Franz Avenue toward Ship Chandler Quay, behind its escort of Coruscantian cavalry. Then the cheers had been undeniably tentative. Loud enough, but uncertain. The southeastern portion of Coruscant had settled into firm loyalty to the Regency Council months earlier, and it had accepted that the Carisian occupation forces were genuinely doing their best to be no more repressive than they must. But the House of Armach was still saddled in all too many minds with the blood guilt of Hector Dakin's murder, and all the world knew how bitterly Charlian of Chisholm had hated the man and, by extension, the princedom she blamed for her father's death. Those cheers of greeting had come from people who had been grateful for the restoration of order and stability and the relative gentleness of the Carisian occupation, so far at least. That wasn't remotely the same as being resigned to permanent Carisian domination, or becoming loyal Carisian subjects. But it had reflected their willingness to at least wait and see. At the same time, there'd been an undeniable dread of what the late Prince Hector's most deadly enemy might have in mind for his princedom, since he himself was beyond her vengeance. In light of her reputation, and even more in light of the way Hector's propagandists had emphasized her hostility to his subjects, it had been no surprise the Coruscantians had hoped, even prayed,
Emperor Caleb had meant his promises that there would be no violent repression, no unnecessary or casual reprisals, and that the rule of law would be respected. And, for that matter, that Charlian would consider herself bound by anything Caleb might have promised. After all, she was his co-ruler, and no one in Coruscant had any way of knowing exactly how the two of them thought that worked. She and Caleb had said all the right things, but still, the fact that those accused of treason had been tried in Coruscantian courts, before the peers and clergy of Coruscant, rather than hauled before a Carisian occupation court, had been hopeful. Yet everyone behind those cheers of greeting and the banners hung out to welcome her had known that if she chose, Charlian Armac could have decreed whatever fate she chose to order. And that was what was different about today's cheers. She could have decreed whatever fate she chose, and she had chosen to abide by the law, as her husband had sworn Caris would. No secret arrests, no condemnations on the basis of tortured confessions, no secret accusers who never had to face the accused, open trials and open verdicts openly arrived at. True, virtually all those verdicts had been guilty, yet even that was different in this case, because the evidence, the proof, had been overwhelming and utterly damning. No one doubted for a moment that anyone accused of treason against Prince Hector would also have been found guilty, but neither did anyone doubt that Hector would have seen little reason to worry about things like evidence and proof. True, she had set aside some of those verdicts, yet unlike Hector, it hadn't been to condemn those who'd been acquitted. Instead, almost a quarter of those who'd been convicted had been pardoned. Not because there'd been any question about their guilt, but because she had chosen to pardon them. It wasn't even the general blanket prison-emptying amnesty some rulers proclaimed as a grand gesture on assuming the throne, or for a wedding, or for the birth of an heir. No, she had pardoned specific individuals, and in every instance she had personally enumerated the reasons she had chosen to show mercy. And she had gone right on doing it, despite the attempt to murder her on her very throne. Coruscant wasn't used to that. For that matter, virtually no save Holdian realm was used to that. And Coruscant still didn't know what to make of it. But Coruscant knew one thing. Charlian Armac, the arch-enemy and arch-hater of Coruscant, was a very different proposition from someone like Zaspar Clintan, or even Hector Dakin. Perhaps she was still, technically at least, an enemy, and certainly she remained one of the foreign potentates who'd conquered their own princedom, but she had conquered something else during her visit to Manchir as well. She had conquered their hearts.
"I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, Your Majesty," General Howell Chermin said, looking out the window of the carriage. He had wanted to accompany Charlian on horseback as part of the security escort, but she had insisted on his joining her in the carriage instead. Now he shook his head and waved one hand at the cheering crowds who lined the streets all the way from the palace to Quayside.
"I remember what these people were like right after Hector was killed. I wouldn't have given a half-chunk copper for your life if you'd come to Manchir then."
The weathered-looking marine's expression was grim, and Charlian smiled fondly at him. There were lines in Sherman's face that hadn't been there before Caleb installed him as the Empire's Viceroy General here in Coruscant. His dark hair had gone entirely iron-grey during his stay as well, and his bushy moustache had turned almost entirely white. Yet his brown eyes were as alert as ever, and his heavy-set muscular body was still undeniably solid-looking, she thought. And well it should be, because if she had had to come up with a single word to encapsulate Howell Chermin, it would have been solid. Well, "From all the reports I've seen, we owe a lot of the improvements to you, General," she said, then winced as the carriage hit an uneven paving stone and sent a stab of pain through her still knitting ribs.
"And if I'd done my job a bit better, Your Majesty," he growled, obviously not having missed her wince, "I'd have had that bastard Henry, begging your pardon for the language, before he ever came that close to killing you."
His face was briefly as iron-like as his hair colour. "His Majesty would never have forgiven me for letting something like that happen."
"What you mean is you'd never have forgiven yourself," Charlian said, leaning forward to pat him on the knee as they sat facing each other. "Which would have been foolish of you, since no one could possibly have done a better job than the one you've done. But that wouldn't have changed a thing, would it?"
It was her turn to shake her head. "You're not exactly a reasonable man where your own duty is concerned, General."
"Good of you to say so anyway, Your Majesty," Sherman said. "But you're being too kind. Letting me off too easily, too, for that matter. If not for Sajin Merlin, he'd have had you. For that matter, I thought at first he had hit you, and so did nearly everyone else, I understand."
"Caleb and I both owe Merlin a great deal," Charlian agreed. "It's not the sort of debt you can really pay, either."
"Not the sort of debt you're supposed to pay, Your Majesty," Jermyn replied. "That's what duty's all about. The only way you can repay that sort of service, the only service that really matters, if you'll pardon my saying so, is by being worthy of it. And I'd say," he looked directly into her eyes, "that so far you and His Majesty have done a pretty fair job of that."
"As you say, General. Good of you to say so anyway," Charlian said demurely and watched his lips twitch on the edge of a smile under the overhanging moustache. Charlian glanced out the window again. They were approaching Ship Chandler Quay at last, and she saw Dawnstar moored against the fenders. She would really have preferred going out to her galleon by boat. Somehow it seemed the proper Carisian way to do things. But Merlin, Sea Hamper, and Sarah Hamlin had flatly refused to contemplate it. So had General Sherman, for that matter, although the disapproval of a mere Viceroy General had scarcely counted compared to that trio's united front. As Merlin and Sergeant Sea Hamper had pointed out, the trip, in an undoubtedly pitching barge, followed by the journey up the ship's side, even in a bosun's chair, would have risked re-injuring the ribs, which still had more than a little healing to do. And as Sarah had unscrupulously thrown into the mix, it would be far safer for Crown Princess Alana to be carried from the carriage across a nice, solid stone quay and up a sturdy gangplank than to subject the child to all the risks of a boat trip.
"I suppose someone who used to be your nurse really does know all the levers to pull," Charlian reflected now, "and it was damned underhanded of her to actually be right about it, too."
She reached across to the bassinet in Sarah's lap and touched her daughter's incredibly soft cheek. Alana's eyes were bright and wide, and she reached happily for her mother's hand. She was such a good baby, most of the time anyway, and she was taking the carriage trip nicely in stride. Of course, she was probably going to make her sense of outraged betrayal loudly apparent the first time Dawnstar hit a patch of rough weather on the trip to Tellersburg. "Definitely your mother's daughter, not your father's, in that regard, aren't you, love?" Charlian thought. She looked up to see Sherman smiling at her, and she smiled back at him.
"Been a while, Your Majesty," the General said with a twinkle. "But I still remember what the first one was like.
And I understand you and Madam Sherman are about to become grandparents."
"Aye, that we are, Your Majesty. My oldest boy, Raz, is expecting his first. In fact, unless Pasquale's changed the rules, the baby's already arrived. I'm sure Mathilde's letter's on its way to tell me all about it.
Are you hoping for a boy or a girl?"
"'Doesn't matter to me, Your Majesty. "'As long as the baby's healthy and got all the right number of arms and legs and what have you, "'I'll be a happy man. "'Although—' "'He looked down at Alana, who was still hanging on to her mother's hand and cooing. "'I guess, if I had to be completely honest, I think I'd like a girl. "'Matilda and I had three boys, and they've been joys most of the time anyway.' He rolled his eyes. "'But I think most men, if they'll be honest about it, "'want at least one daughter or granddaughter to spoil. "'And—' his smile faded slightly. "'I've three sons in harm's way. "'I could wish I had at least one daughter who wasn't.' "'I can understand that,' Charlian touched his knee again. "'But it's sons like yours—' "'who stand between everyone's daughters and men like Zaspar Clintan, General. "'Be proud of them, and tell them the next time you have the chance "'how grateful Caleb and I are for all four of you.' "'I will, Your Majesty,' Jermyn said a bit gruffly, then cleared his throat. "'I see we're almost at Chipside, Your Majesty,' he said in a deliberately brisker voice, and she nodded. "'So we are.' "'Well, I suppose it's time for all of the ridiculous departure ceremony. "'I'd as soon miss it myself, truth be told,' Sherman admitted. "'And I don't envy you and His Majesty for having to put up with so much of it, to be honest.' "'He looked at her with an undeniably hopeful expression. "'I'd like to think it might be possible for someone else to take over as Viceroy General "'and let me get away from all the fuss and falderal and back to being an honest Marine.' "'Or even transfer to the army.' "'I don't know, General,' Charlian said, "'furrowing her brow pensively "'while she tried not to chuckle out loud "'at the opening he had given her. "'You've done so well here, "'and while I know the situation's improved, "'it's still going to be delicate "'for quite some time to come.' "'I know, Your Majesty,' Sherman sighed. "'He obviously hadn't expected to convince her.' "'Still,' Charlian said, drawing out the word as the carriage came to a halt "'and Merlin Athroys and Edward Seahamper swung down from their horses beside it. "'I suppose I can think of one other duty. "'Caleb and I really need a good, experienced military officer "'and proven administrator to deal with. "'I'm afraid it's not a combat assignment.' Although, for all I know, there may be some fighting entailed, but it would get you out of Coruscant, she ended hopefully, raising her eyebrows at him. I'd be honoured to serve you and His Majesty in any way I could, Your Majesty, Sherman said, although he couldn't quite hide his disappointment at the words, it's not a combat assignment. Well, I suppose in that case— "'We could send Baron Green Valley down here to replace you, at least temporarily,' Charlian said. "'Are you certain about that, Your Majesty?' Sherman sounded a little startled. "'I understood the Baron was going to be fully occupied in Zebediah for quite some time.' "'Oh, he's been doing a very good job there,' Charlian agreed with a nod. "'And Duke Eastchair— "'Wants him back in Michaelberg, of course, "'so we may not be able to send him as your replacement after all. "'Still, I'm sure we'll be able to find someone. "'In fact, now that I've thought about it for a moment, "'I think your Colonel Zanstin could probably hold the fort for you, "'possibly even on a semi-permanent or a permanent basis. "'But as far as Baron Green Valley is concerned, "'he was never going to be our permanent viceroy in Zebediah.' "'He wasn't?' Jermyn looked at her in surprise as Seahamper moved to open the carriage door and led down the steps while Merlin stood facing outward, eyes scanning the crowd. She cocked her head at the marine, and he half-raised one hand. "'I'm sorry, Your Majesty. I must have misunderstood. "'The Baron's a very good man, General.' But he was only there to keep a lid on the island until we could decide who to name to succeed Simmons as Grand Duke. That was hardly an easy decision, of course. We needed a man of proven ability and loyalty. Someone we knew we could absolutely rely upon, and to be honest, someone
who deserved the recognition and the rewards which were going to come along with all the undeniable pains of straightening out the mess Simmons left behind. Trust me, the position's not going to be a sinecure for a long time to come, General. Chairman nodded in understanding, and she shrugged. And once we did make up our mind who to choose, naturally we'd have to notify the new Grand Duke before we could even think about recalling Baron Green Valley, which I've just done, now that I think about it. Grand Duke Zebediah. Her timing was perfect, she thought delightedly. The door opened right on cue, as Sherman suddenly stopped nodding and stared at her in stupefied shock. He opened his mouth, but no words came out, and Charlian nodded at Sarah, who looked as if her grin were about to split her face in two as she gathered up Princess Alana's bassinet and diaper bag. "Well, I see we're here, Your Grace, if I may be a little premature," Empress Charlian Armach said, bestowing a brilliant smile on the thunderstruck marine. And then she held out her hand to Sea Hamper and descended the carriage steps into a hurricane of cheers, trumpets, and the thud of saluting guns. July, Year of God, 895. 1. Hospice of the Holy Bedard and the Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands.
Langhorne bless you, Your Grace. Langhorne bless you.
Thank you, Father, Robert Duchesne said. I appreciate the sentiment, but it's not as if I've been working as hard at this as you have, or, the vicar's smile carried an odd edge of bitterness, for as long, either. He laid a hand on Father Zintan Quill's frail shoulder. The Bedardist upper priest was far into his 80s and growing increasingly fragile with age, yet he burned with an inner intensity Duchesne could only envy.
"That may be true, Your Grace," Quill replied, "but this winter," he shook his head, "do you realize we've had only 30 dead reported in the hospice this winter from all causes? Only 30.
"I know," Duchesne nodded, although he also knew considerably more than 30 of Zion's inhabitants had perished over the previous winter. Yet Quill had a point. The Order of Bedard and the Order of Pasquale were responsible for caring for Zion's poor and indigent. Well, technically, all Mother Church's orders had that duty, but the Bedardists and the Pasqualates had shouldered the primary responsibility centuries earlier. They jointly administered the soup kitchens and the shelters, and the Pasqualates provided the healers who were supposed to see that the most vulnerable of God's children had the medical care to survive Zion's icy cold. The problem, of course, was that they hadn't been doing that. Duchesne looked out the window of Quill's Spartan office. The Hospice of the Holy Bedard was in one of Zion's older buildings, and the office had a spectacular view of the broad blue waters of Lake Pei. But it was as bare and sparsely furnished as an ascetic cell in one of the meditative monasteries. No doubt that reflected Father Zaitan's personality, but it was also because the priest had poured every mark he could lay hands on into his hopeless task for the last 47 years. With so many desperate needs, the thought of spending anything on himself would never even have crossed his mind. And in all that time, Mother Church has never supported him the way she should have, the treasurer thought grimly. Not once, not a single time have we funded him and the others the way we ought to have. The vicar crossed to the window, clasping his hands behind him, looking out at the leaves and blossoms which clothed the hills striding down from Zion to the huge lake. A cool breeze blew in through the opening, touching his face with gentle fingers, and the sails of small craft, barges, and larger merchant ships dotted the sparkling water under the sun's warm rays.
He could see fishing boats farther out, and perfectly formed mountains of clouds sailed across the heavens. On a day like this, it was easy even for Duchern, who had spent the last 30 years of his life in Zion, to forget how savage north-central Haven's winters truly were. To forget how the lake turned into a blue and grey sheet of ice, thick enough to support galleon-sized ice boats. To forget how snow drifted higher than a tall man's head in the city's streets. How some of those drifts, on the city's outskirts, climbed as much as 2 or even 3 stories up the sides of buildings. And it's even easier for those of us who spend our winters in the temple to forget that sort of unpleasantness, he acknowledged. We don't have to deal with it, do we? We have our own little enclave, blessed by God, and we don't venture out of it, except perhaps on the milder days when the wind doesn't howl and fresh blizzards don't go screaming around our sanctified ears. He wanted to believe that was the reason for his own decades of inactivity. Wanted to think he'd been so busy, so focused on his manifold responsibilities, that he'd simply gotten distracted. That he'd honestly forgotten to actually look out his window and see what was happening to those outside the temple's mystically heated and cooled environment because he'd been so preoccupied with his personal duties and obligations. Oh, how he wanted to think that. You were preoccupied, all right, Robert, he told himself, filling his lungs with the cool air, inhaling the scent of the blossoms in the planter under Father Zaitan's window. You were preoccupied with fine wines, gourmet cooking, charming feminine companionship, and all the arduous tasks of counting coins and managing your alliances within the vicarate. Pity you didn't stop to think about what the archangels themselves told you were any priest's true obligations and duties. If you had, Father Zaitan might have had the money and the resources he needed to actually do something about those responsibilities. I'm overjoyed we lost so few this winter, Father, he said, not looking away from the window. I only regret that we lost so many the winter before. And the winter before that. Quill looked at the vicar's back, silhouetted against the bright windows, and wondered if Duchern realized how much pain rested like an anchor in the depths of his own voice. The vicar was a Chihirite, like the majority of Mother Church's administrators. Without the trained insight into feelings and emotional processes that Quill's own order taught, perhaps he truly didn't understand his own feelings, or how clearly his tone communicated them at any rate, or how dangerous they could be to him under the present circumstances. "Your Grace," the upper priest said, "I've spent considerably better than half my life feeling exactly that same regret every spring." Duchern turned his head to look at him. And Quill smiled sadly. "I suppose we should grow inured to it when it happens again and again, but everybody we find buried in the snow, every child who becomes an orphan, every soul we can't somehow cram into the hospice or one of the other shelters when the temperature drops and the wind comes screaming in off the lake, every single one of those deaths takes its own tiny piece of my soul with it. I've never learned to accept it, but I've had to learn to deal with it, to admit to myself that I truly did everything I could to minimize those deaths, and to absolve myself of the guilt for them. It isn't easy to do that. No matter how much I've done, I'm always convinced I could, that I should, have done still more. I can know here," he touched his temple gently, "that I truly did all I could. But it's hard to accept that here." He touched his chest, and his sad smile grew gentler. "I've had more practice trying to do that than you have, Your Grace. Partly
because I'm the next best thing to 35 years older than you are. And I realize most people here in Zion and even in my own order seem to think I've been doing what I do since the creation itself. The truth is, though, I was past 40 before it even occurred to me that this should be my life's work, that it was what God had in mind for me to do. He shook his head. Don't think for a moment all the years I wasted before I heard his voice don't come back to haunt me every winter, reminding me of all those earlier winters when I did nothing at all. I realize there are those who think of me as some sort of saintly paragon. Those that don't think I'm an ordinary old crackpot at any rate. But I was a much duller student than those people think. We hear him when we hear him, and it's up to him to judge us. It's not up to others, and our own judgment is sometimes the least reliable of all, especially where our own actions are concerned. You're probably right, Father, Duchenne said after a long, silent moment. Yet if we don't judge ourselves, if we don't hold ourselves accountable, we turn our backs not just on our responsibilities, but on ourselves. I've discovered guilt makes a bitter seasoning, but without it, it's too easy to lose ourselves. Of course it is, Your Grace, Quill said simply. But if God says he's willing to forgive us when we recognize our faults and genuinely seek to amend our lives, then shouldn't we be willing to do the same thing? You truly are a Bedadist, aren't you, Father? Duchenne shook his head wryly. And I'll try to bear your advice in mind. But the writ says we're supposed to make recompense to the best of our ability, to those we realize we've wronged. I'm afraid it's going to take me a while to accomplish that. Quill crossed the office to stand beside him at the window. But the priest didn't look out across the lake. Instead, he stood for several seconds, regarding the vicar intently, gazing into his eyes. Then he reached out and laid a hand, thinned by a lifetime's labours, on Duchenne's chest. I think this is in a better state, and far, far deeper than even you realize, Your Grace, he said softly. But be careful. Even the greatest of hearts can accomplish nothing in this world after it ceases to beat. Duchenne laid his hand across the priest's for a moment and inclined his head in what might have been agreement or simple acknowledgement. Then he inhaled deeply and stepped back. As always, Father Zaitan, it's been both a joy and a privilege, he said more briskly. And I'm pleased with your report, especially since I've managed to free up the funding to acquire or build additional shelters for the coming winter. Depending on where we place them, it would probably be cheaper to purchase and refurbish existing structures, and if we're going to be forced to build, it would be a good idea to get started as quickly as possible. So please give some thought to where the housing will be most urgently required. I'd like to have your recommendations for 3 or 4 new sites within the next couple of 5 days. Of course, Your Grace. And thank you. Quill smiled broadly. We can always use additional roofs when the snow flies. I'll do my best, Father. Just as I'll do my best to bear your advice in mind. Duchenne extended his hand, and Quill bent to brush his ring of office with his lips, then straightened. Until next time, Father. May the holy Bedard bless and keep you, Your Grace, Quill muttered in response. Duchenne nodded and left the office. His escort of temple guardsmen was waiting for him, of course. They didn't like letting him out of their sight, even for his meetings with Father Zaitan, and despite their discipline, it showed in their expression. Of course, there's more than one reason for that unhappiness at having me off doing Langhorn knows what, Duchenne thought with bitter amusement. Where to now, Your Grace?
The officer in command of his personal security detachment inquired politely. "Back to the temple, Major Fundies," Duchenne said to the man Zaspar Clintan and Alan Megware had personally selected as his keeper. Their eyes met, and the vicar smiled thinly. "Back to the temple," he repeated.
"Major Fundies is here, Your Eminence."
"Thank you, Father. Send him in." "Of course, Your Eminence." The secretary bowed and withdrew. A moment later, Major Constanzo Fundies entered Willem Reyno's office. He crossed to the archbishop and bent over his extended hand to kiss his ring. "You sent for me, Your Eminence," the major said as he straightened. Technically, as a temple guardsman, he ought to have saluted instead of kissing Reyno's ring. Since the botched arrest of the Wilson brothers, however, Major Fundies had become considerably more than a simple guardsman. It was scarcely his fault that arrest had gone so radically wrong, and the Inquisition had always had a keen eye for a talent that could be co-opted without officially becoming part of the Order of Shula.
"Yes, I did, Major."
Reyno sat back down behind his desk, tipped his chair back, and surveyed Fundies thoughtfully.
"I've read your latest report. As always, it was complete, concise, and to the point. I could wish more of the reports which crossed my desk were like it."
"Thank you, Your Eminence," Fundies murmured when the Archbishop paused, obviously expecting some response. "I strive to offer Mother Church and the Inquisition my best effort."
"Indeed you do, Major." Reyno smiled with unusual warmth. "In fact, I've been considering whether or not I might be able to find an even more effective use for a man of your talents and piety."
"I'm always prepared to serve wherever Mother Church can best make use of me, Your Eminence," Fundies replied. "Have you someone in mind for my current responsibilities?"
"No, not really."
Reyno's smile faded.
"No, I'm afraid I don't, Major. That's one reason I called you in. Can you think of anyone else in the Guards suitable for the position?"
Fundies frowned for several seconds, hands clasped respectfully behind him while he considered. "Off the top of my head, no, I'm afraid, Your Eminence." He shook his head regretfully. "I can think of several whose loyalty and devotion would make them suitable, but none who have the rank to serve as Vicar Robert's senior guardsman. Of those who do have the rank, I'm afraid I'd have reservations about recommending most of them. There might be one or two of sufficient rank and seniority, but none who could be assigned to him without a series of transfers to make them the logical choices. I can give you their names if you like, Your Eminence, although I'd strongly recommend you interview them personally before you consider them for my current assignment."
"Your reasons?"
Reyno's tone was honestly curious, and Fundies shrugged. "I'd hesitate to recommend anyone I don't know personally and reasonably well, Your Eminence. But I doubt anyone ever knows someone as well as he thinks he does. And the fact that most of them are friendly, or at least close acquaintances, would tend to make me suspect my own judgment. I'd simply feel more comfortable if someone with a more detached perspective decided whether or not they'd be suitable for the duty."
"I see."
Reyno considered that for a moment. For a rather long moment, in fact. As he'd already suggested, the Inquisition always had far too many demands for men of talent and ability, and that was especially so these days. Fundies was already young for his current rank, but Reyno could easily have him promoted to colonel or even brigadier. Yet deciding whether or not to do that represented something of a balancing act. While the higher rank would give him greater seniority and authority, it would also make him even more of a marked man among his fellows. It was sadly true that the more closely identified with the Inquisition an officer became, the less his fellows tended to confide in him. Besides,
"Please do provide me with those recommendations, Major," he said at length. "Even if I decide to leave you in your present assignment, it never hurts for the Inquisition to know where to lay its hand on Mother Church's dutiful sons when she needs them worst." "Of course, Your Eminence." Fandys bowed slightly. "I'll have them for you by tomorrow afternoon, if that will be soon enough." "That will be fine, Major," Reyno said, and waved one hand in dismissal.
"Well," Zaspar Clintan said as Willem Reyno entered his office, "what's our good friend Robert been up to lately?"
"According to all my sources, Your Grace, he's been doing precisely what he said he was going to do. He paid another visit to Father Zaitan yesterday, and he's scheduled a meeting next 5 days with the senior pasquilates from all 5 major hospitals to discuss the coordination of healers with his shelters and soup kitchens for next winter." The Archbishop shrugged. "Apparently, he wants to be better organized than he was this winter."
Clintan rolled his eyes. He didn't have anything against a practical, reasonable level of charitable works, but the vicars of Mother Church weren't supposed to allow themselves to be distracted from their own responsibilities. At a time like this, the Church's chief financial officer had dozens of concerns upon which he might more profitably spend his time than worrying about a winter which was still months away. The Grand Inquisitor leaned back, the fingers of his right hand drumming an irritated tattoo on his desk. Duchern's excessive, gushy piety was becoming more and more exasperating. Yet all the old arguments against allowing the Group of Four's potential enemies to suspect a genuine division in their ranks remained, although those arguments were growing weaker as the example he had made of the Wilson circle of pro-reformist traitors sank fully home. If not for that, he'd cheerfully contemplate jettisoning Duchern. Unfortunately, if he purged Duchern, he'd have to come up with someone else to do the man's job, and the unpalatable fact was that no one else could do it as well as he did. That consideration was especially pointed, given Mother Church's current straitened financial condition. No, he concluded yet again. Regretfully, he couldn't get rid of Duchern yet, however much the man's soft-hearted, mushy-brained sanctimony sickened him. Of course, the reasons he couldn't, those same straitened financial conditions, only made the other vicar's obsession with providing for the poor even more maddening. Still, if Clintan had no choice anyway, he might as well look at the bright side. Judging by the tenor of his own agent's reports, Duchern's demand that the Group of Four show a kinder, gentler face truly was helping to bolster morale here in Zion. That sort of bought-and-paid-for loyalty was always a perishable commodity, far less reliable than the instant obedience instilled by the Inquisition's discipline, but it was probably useful in the short term, at least. "What about Fandys?" he asked, and Reyno considered his response carefully. The Major had become one of Zaspar Clintan's favourites, although that outcome might not have been assured, given the way he had deprived the Grand Inquisitor of one of his most anticipated prizes. Even Clintan had accepted that that was scarcely his fault when he had found himself face to face with Howard Wilson in personal combat, however, and without Fandys, the Wilsons might actually have managed to get out of Zion. They wouldn't have gotten far, but the fact that they'd had the chance to run at all would have undermined the Inquisition's aura of invincibility. The Grand Inquisitor had chosen to look on the bright side, which explained how Captain Fandys had become Major Fandys.
"I understand your desire to make the best and fullest use of Major Fandys, Your Grace," the Archbishop said after a moment, "and I'm looking into possible replacements for him in his current assignment. With all due respect, however, at this time I think it would be wiser to leave him where he is.
Why? Clintan asked tersely, and Reynaud shrugged.
As the Major himself pointed out to me this afternoon, Your Grace, finding someone equally reliable to replace him as Vicar Robert's chief guardian would be difficult. He's prepared to recommend some potential candidates, but Vicar Alain would be forced to juggle assignments rather obviously to put one of them into Major Fandy's present position. And, to be totally honest, the more I've thought about it, the more convinced I am that we really do need to keep one of our best and most observant people in charge of Vicar Robert's security. The Grand Inquisitor scowled. Yet the point about keeping an eye on Duchesne was well taken, at least until they could find someone to replace him as treasurer. Duchesne clearly knew Fandys was spying on him for the Inquisition, but he seemed resigned to the fact, and the Major had demonstrated a surprising degree of tact. He went out of his way to avoid stepping on Duchesne's toes, and it was always possible the treasurer actually appreciated his courtesy. As for Reynaud's other argument, personally Clintan wouldn't have given a damn if Makeware had to rearrange assignments to put someone else into Fandy's position. But there was still that pestiferous, irritating need to preserve the fiction that the group of four remained fully united. If it became too obvious Clintan and Makeware were assigning their own men to spy on Duchesne and Trinair, some of the currently cowed vicars might find themselves dangerously, or at least inconveniently, emboldened. And, truth to tell, Duchesne was less predictable in many ways than Trinair, given the Chancellor's predictable and manipulable pragmatism and self-interest. Reynaud was right, he decided. Better to keep one of their best men right where he was until the time finally came to be shut of Duchesne entirely. "All right," he growled. "I hate wasting someone of his abilities as a glorified nursemaid. But I suppose you have a point." He frowned for another few seconds, then shrugged. "All right," he said again, in a very different tone, changing subjects with his accustomed abruptness. "Watch this we hear from Coruscant." "Obviously. Our latest information is sadly out of date, as always, Your Grace," Reynaud said a bit cautiously. "But, according to my current reports, all of those arrested last year have now been tried. Formal sentencing is awaiting the arrival of either Caleb or Charlian, probably Charlian, but all indications are that the overwhelming majority of those arrested..." Even the redoubtable Reynaud paused almost imperceptibly to brace himself. "Have been found guilty." Clintan's expression hardened, and his jowls darkened, yet that was all. Some people might have been relieved by his apparent lack of reaction, but Reynaud knew the Grand Inquisitor better than that. "I don't suppose," Clintan said in an icy tone, "that anyone in that traitorous bastard Gerling's church raised a single voice in protest."
"So far as I know, no, Your Grace." Reynaud cleared his throat. "According to our sources, Gerling appointed clerics to the courts hearing the accusations as part of the farce that all the required legal procedures had been followed."
"Of course he did." Clintan's jaw muscles quivered for a moment. "We already knew that son of a bitch Anvil Rock and his catamite Tartarian were willing to whore for Caleb and his bitch any way they asked. So of course the Church of Caris is going to just stand by and watch the judicial murder of Mother Church's loyal sons and daughters. What else could we expect?"
His face darkened steadily, and Reynaud braced himself. But then, to the Archbishop's surprise, the Grand Inquisitor wrapped his hands tightly together on his desk, hunched his shoulders, and visibly fought his rage back under control. It didn't come easily, and he didn't manage it quickly, but he did manage it in the end. You say formal announcement of the verdicts is awaiting Charlian's arrival? He asked at last in a hard, tight voice.
Yes, Your Grace. In fact, if she's kept to the schedule which was reported to us, she's already there. She may actually be ready to depart by now.
So what you're saying is that they have been announced by now, and presumably carried out as well.
Clintan bared his teeth.
The bitch isn't going to leave without the satisfaction of seeing them all killed, now is she?
Presumably not, Your Grace.
Do we have any indication of how the population in general is responding to all of this?
Not really, Your Grace.
Reno twitched his shoulders unhappily.
So far, there haven't been any indications of organized protest or outrage, but again, all our reports are months out of date by the time they get here. It's always possible. People have been waiting for confirmation of the verdicts before they reacted.
And it's always possible they're just going to sit on their asses and let it happen, too, Clintan said flatly.
I'm afraid so, Reno admitted.
Then it may be time to stiffen their spines. Clintan's expression was ugly. What's the situation with Corus?
Nothing seems to have changed in that regard, Your Grace. As you know, I've got one of our best men planted on him,
and Bishop Mitchell has his own agent in King Zaim's household as well.
Both of them agree Corus is doing what he was told to do,
and that he will do what we need him to do?
Almost certainly, Your Grace.
Only almost. Clintan's eyes narrowed.
I doubt he'd hesitate for a moment, Your Grace, if it weren't for the fact that everyone knows he was Hector's spymaster, the man who managed Hector's assassins, among other things. He has a reputation for personal ambition, and it might occur to him that if anyone was going to be blamed as Caleb's tool in Davin's assassination, it would be him. Under the circumstances, I think he'd probably prefer not to give any additional credence to that kind of charge. That assessment is based at least in part on reports from Master C. Blanket, our agent in his household.